Okay, when we get back started talking about you were asked by Al to become vice president of.
Well, what happened was there were at the time there were about 30 vice presidents throughout the country.
And this is about 78.
78. And about one third, 10 or 11, were from New York State. And that was not disproportionate. As a matter of fact, that made New York State still unrepresentative because at the time, I think New York State was about 40% of the membership. Mm-hmm. So we had about 10 out of 30, about one third. And of that one third, it was kind of, I think it was just part of what happened was that the officers of NYSET became vice presidents of the AFT. So when I was elected secretary treasurer in March of 78, I was then asked by Al to be a vice president of the AFT. So I became a vice president of AFT in 1978. And when I retired from NYSET in 1994, Al asked me to stay on. I said I would like to. It was a non-paying position. I just did it because I love doing it. And I stayed until last year. Right. So I was in vice president of AFT from 1978 till 2004, 28 years.
Jeez.
2006, 28 years. And I think I may have been the only vice president who stayed on more than the rest of his two-year term after retiring.
Mm-hmm.
I think I am. And it was during that time, frankly, that I think I probably did some of my most important stuff, which was chairing the Futures 2 Committee and being the driving force for the Solidarity Fund, which brings in about $5-7 million a year for our political action program. So that's the period that I can cover for you.
Right. Okay.
And now, by the way, there are, as the union grew, you needed more and more representation on the executive council, the vice presidents.
Okay.
So that now there are, I think, 39 vice presidents.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Plus three officers. So you have a council of 42.
They took up a big room. What were some of the first duties as a vice president that they assigned you?
Well, I was, there was a carryover from years ago that vice presidents would be assigned certain states.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a carryover from a very early time when there were hardly any full-time people on AFT. And so vice presidents would kind of be the AFT liaison responsible for their own state, plus whatever states were possibly in their immediate area. And so I had, I was given Kansas, Alaska.
Nice.
And most of those 28 years, my assignment was overseas. And that reflects the fact that very early on, and I don't remember what year, but it was very early on, Al asked me to chair the Democracy Committee, which is really, we called it the Democracy Committee. It was originally known as the International Affairs Committee. And I chaired that committee for almost the full 28 years.
Okay.
The other assignment, when Ed McElroy, when he was a vice president, chaired the COPE committee. And when Ed went to the executive committee, which was probably sometime, I'm guessing, in the mid-80s, Al asked me to also chair the COPE committee. So I chaired those two committees. The COPE committee, of course, was a committee that was that tried to be helpful to the COPE department in motivating affiliates to provide COPE monies, you know. You know that we can't use dues money for federal elections. So the only way we could have a federal program of support to legislators was to collect free money, right, collect voluntary contributions.
Is you working with Rochelle and her department?
Yeah. And but essentially, I mean, what it was, these committees would meet usually at each council meeting. There were four council meetings a year. And what we would do would be to try to motivate the council leadership to be more involved. One of the ways we did that was we would put out a list for every council member. This is how much you've contributed. But, and the other thing was to try to be of help in getting more grassroots involvement. Yeah. And by the way, that's something that Eddie, I think, has taken very seriously, in that he spends a good deal of time going around the country and motivating grassroots activity. So that, I mean, it was clear when I was a legislative rep at, did all the legislative work for NYSET, of course I would go in and meet with the governor and the legislative leaders and the speaker and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But what was really effective was when you had our members in their districts meeting with them and coming to legislative functions that we would have, you know, for the legislators. And they would see that the folks who were their constituents, that really made it tremendous difference. And Eddie, I think, is spending a good deal of time trying to do that. That's good.
That's the kind of thing he really likes, that grassroots thing.
I should spend a little time with you before I forget on the futures.
You want to cover futures now? Sure.
Yeah, maybe so.
Okay.
Or at another time. Why don't we go by you?
Okay. No, if it's on your mind, we'll go with it now. Why don't you explain what the futures committee is?
Yeah, there were two futures committees, futures one and futures two, back to the future.
And I hear there's a rumor of future three.
What?
Yeah, I heard a rumor.
Futures one came about as a result of a number of discussions on the Executive Council dealing with the whole matter of how the union approaches its very new constituencies.
These are the public employees, the nurses.
Yeah, here we go. PEF comes in, we start to organize nurses, and there were a couple of discussions at the council. Council meetings, by and large, were pretty good meetings. I mean, I had interesting discussions. And I remember a couple of times when Candy Owley would say, you know, this is all interesting stuff, but it's all about education. Or the PEF folks would say, you know, it's good stuff, but not a lot of, you know, and so that motivated a lot of folks, particularly Al and Sandy and some others, to say, you know, we really should get away, because at the council meetings there is so much business that has to be done. Mm-hmm. It's hard to spend time on think rather than act. And say, well, we should really get away for 3-4 days, have a retreat, start to talk about how we deal with the fact that we are no longer just a teachers' union, we're becoming no longer just an educators' union. What is it that we are? Mm-hmm. And what is it that we want to be, and how we want to get there, and blah, blah, blah. And Al knew this guy, Mike Maccabee, who we used as a facilitator. And out of that...
Was this at Hilton Head?
It was at Hilton Head.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay.
How'd you know that?
I know things. I'm your archivist. I know a lot of things.
Lock the closets, please. It turned into about a year's project. And we had three or four retreats. And out of that came some very important changes. Mm-hmm. Said, look, if we're really serious about organizing, first of all, we came to the conclusion that what we were was something that includes education, but is not only education. We said, what we really are, a union of professionals providing services to the public. And that opened it all up. And then we said, in addition to the council, number one, we are getting so big that 38 or 39, what are we going to end up with, 400 people, vice presidents? Mm-hmm. It's got to be another mechanism to include more people in the thought process. Number two, there has to be an opportunity not only for educators but for all the other constituencies to go through the kinds of discussions on professional matters that education goes through without them having to listen to us at all. And that's how we got to the different constituencies. So now that you have five constituencies which are recognized in the Constitution, mm-hmm. and now you have PPCs, the professional, what is PPC?
Professional.
The Professional Practices Committees.
Yes, there you go.
Right?
There we go.
Okay. Something like
that. Yeah.
And so when the council meets for 2 days before or 2 days after, the PPCs meet. Now that was an opportunity to bring into leadership many more people without having 150 vice presidents. You had members of the PPCs, and they were the up-and-coming people. And a lot of the, as the vice presidents retire, a lot of PPC people kind of take their place as vice presidents.
Right.
So Futures One was significant in changing the way we think about ourselves and providing a change in structure for us to deal with the substantive issues that each of the constituencies need to deal with. However, we still maintain that once those PPCs come up with recommendations, they still have to come to the body as a whole, to the council. Council is still the official policy-making body, not the PPCs. But it's almost a rubber stamp, unless it's something outrageously crazy. The nurses sat down, they spent 6 months on this, they bring it to the council, unless it's insane, it's going to be approved.
Right.
But the council still maintains its constitutional authority as the policy-making body when the convention is not together.
This is, early 90s? When it was released? So AFT staff is already a large organization all to itself. What was their reaction to the development of Future and creating the PPCs? Do they feel threatened? Do they feel input?
If they felt threatened, I was not aware of it. We did have a number of top staff people participate by being resource people, I don't recall if they were sitting at the table or not. I don't recall. Mm-hmm. So that was Futures One. Substantive change in the outlook of the nature of the organization, substantive structural change to include the new groups. Futures Two. Sandy and Eddie. Now, by the time Futures 2 came, do you have a copy of Futures 2?
Yeah.
Okay. I was already retired from NYSA, still a vice president. They asked me if I would, instead of bringing somebody from outside like Maccabee, would I run Futures 2? Mm-hmm. Yes. Futures 2 was very different than Futures 1. Futures 1 was there because fundamental changes in structure had to be made. Futures 2 was motivated by a sense that everybody in the organization, in this really big organization, wasn't really on board as to what our mission was. That we had a tremendous number of state affiliates and local affiliates, but it wasn't clear that all of us had a common vision and mission. And so we wanted a process which, where the process was just as important, if not more important, than the product. Because it was designed to include as many activists as possible throughout the country to talk about what are the important issues that the AFT and its affiliates need to deal with, and can we come up with something that we all believe in. The process was very important, and we spent, lots of us, the officers, council members, having meetings around the country, went to almost every workshop, went to the conventions, the state conventions, went to conferences, and spent time talking about this and came up with a series of issues, the matter of political action, the matter of affiliates, of the various departments working together rather than apart, which was always a problem.
Oh, so you were talking
the matter
to staff
of organizing,
too.
Yeah.
Okay.
The matter of organizing, and we would after I would give a presentation on the nature of the discussions that we wanted to have, we would break up into groups of 10 and 12. So there were literally thousands of members that spent 2 or 3 hours discussing, and we would have, you know, facilitators write everything and bring it all into us, so on and so forth. When you look at Futures 2, I don't think there's anything in there that moves us in a different direction. It's not meant to. What it was meant to do was to provide something that represented a commonality of purpose that articulated what all of us concluded was the important 3 or 4 most important activities that AFT needs to address at all levels. And this one, by the way, we brought to the convention.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked the convention, it was a booklet, but it was a convention resolution. So it was kind of a way of saying we need a mechanism to bring some consensus on a very broad basis on what the important matters are that we deal with. Out of that came a number of activities. Out of that came creation of the organizing committee of the AFT, which to this day meets 3 or 4 times a year. Out of that came a whole series of recommendations on political activity and COPE, COPE work.
Does this lead to the Solidarity Fund?
And it led to the Solidarity Fund. Now, the Solidarity Fund, we did the same thing. It was usually the dues increases would be 45 cents per member, you know, 50 cents, 30 cents, so on and so forth. But the year of Solidarity Fund, we asked for $1.25 or something. I mean, it was a big number. And what we did was, we said, if we're going to ask for a significant increase forever, it has to be done in a way that it's not just providing resources to the national. It has to also provide resources to the state affiliates that they can use in the locals for political work. So we came up with a formula. For every, we started with 75 cents per member, 46 cents went to the state, 20, you know, whatever it was, 29 cents went to. And we went around the country. Again, we did the same damn thing. The process was what was important. There were people, particularly those from Florida, who got up and spoke about how difficult it would be and how, you know, there's too much money going to dues. You know, you always have that. But the interesting thing was, and the thing I really felt best about with the Solidarity Fund, was it passed almost unanimously at the convention. I don't think there were more than four people who voted against it. So there was, and by the way, when we started this, we said, if this thing is passed 52-48, that's a loser, you know? And so, again, I want to talk about process, because I think one of the things that really goes to the heart of AFT is inclusiveness. It really is important. I mean, it is a grassroots process. And it's what I think makes AFT a union that is still able to thrive, although any local affiliate can leave any time it wants. Mm-hmm. It's all voluntary. And that forces leadership to be sensitive to membership in a good way. And that's what we did with the Solidarity Fund and with Futures too. And it, I think it strengthens the organization to do that.
Motivated the organization?
Pardon?
Did it motivate the organization?
I think so. I mean, I see in the years following Futures 2 and Solidarity, I see a lot of support for the stuff in those reports. I don't see backsliding and people saying, you know, why are we doing this? For instance, we also put into the guidelines for the Solidarity Fund that all monies expended from the Solidarity, we put in transparency. Not only will all monies expended go through the Executive Council, but every single convention will get a detailed report of state by state what they did with the monies, and they will get a report of all the national monies. How is every delegate gets a list? This is how we spent the money. So it builds in, you know, well, what are they doing with the money?
Yeah, it's the accountability.
It builds in the accountability.
Right. Yeah.
So I just want to say that because I think that's why I started by saying those two, the process was just as important as the outcome, as the product.
So you were able to talk to the small locals with six members, to the UFT, and to the Chicagos and Los Angeles, and combine everything together. That's a huge undertaking. But the small locals, the future too, address the issues with the large cities in the states, meaning like Illinois, Chicago has a large membership.
The one thing that still needs doing, that is a problem for AFT's state affiliates, is that in too many states, the large locals have not been able or been motivated to give to the state affiliate the strength that it would need to be more effective on the state level. And on the one hand, it's very human and understandable that large locals would not want to give up certain powers that they feel they have. On the other hand, it's only a statewide organization that can create the kind of power that is necessary to represent those, even the large locals. I mean, one of the wonderful things about Al's foresight was that here he was the president of the strongest local in the country, and he still understood that he wasn't strong enough.
Mm-hmm.
He understood that even though there were 30 assemblymen from New York State, that there were 150 assemblymen, you know, throughout the country,
right,
and throughout the state, and he understood that it was important to have the city union support things that are needed by the upstate unions for the upstate unions to be willing to do the other way. And that, by the way, that's why NYSA and UFT supported what's called Save Harmless, the small locals upstate. Save Harmless is in the funding formula for state education. Those little locals, no matter what the formula is, they don't get less. They are saved harmless from getting less money. So that, and UFT supported it. But it's also true that as a result of that, when UFT had the Stavisky bill mm-hmm. about funding in New York, we were able to get that through, even though the governor was buttonholing everybody up there, because we had to override, because the upstate locals understood that that was in the interest of New York City, and New York City had come to their aid. And it's that kind of foresight that was so helpful in creating NYSA into what it is today. That hasn't happened in most states yet. Now, part of that is because a lot of the states just don't have enough of a constituency outside of the urban areas. But there are places where they do. It's interesting to see in the merged states, in Florida, in Montana, you know, in Minnesota.
They're doing this.
They're doing this.
Yeah. But you were trying to approach this with Futures too.
Well, yeah, Futures. But not directly.
Okay.
Not directly.
Okay. What are the other things that Futures too also have a huge? What most of the press talked about was the organizing, pushing the organizing again. We've always been organizing. I mean, AFT's always had a budget that's more than most unions on organizing. What was the address there?
Well, I think that what one of the aspects of organizing at AFT was that most of the affiliates thought of organizing as a national function. But there were certain things in the state. It would be very helpful to have the state affiliates think of themselves as having an important organizing function. Again, because unless you're big enough, you're not going to be able to develop strength.
Mm-hmm.
And so to the extent that state affiliates are able to expand, it's in their interest, not just for the people who are organizing, but for themselves. And that states are reluctant to do it. It's the chicken and egg thing, because they don't want, they say, hey, we're a service organization. I want to organize, I understand that, but I'm not going to do it by taking money from my service and weakening the members that I have. So there's that.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons that out of Futures 2's organizing committee came a proposal that says the national will provide funds, resources, for organizing to certain states, but the states have to commit themselves to also put resources in. And there's a formula.
Right.
You know? So it's a way of trying to entice and, you know,
right,
motivate.
Right. Were some of the states hesitant at first?
the smaller states?
Yeah, look, you know, some of the states are up to their ears in being attacked and and just fighting the good fight.
Right.
And this is, organizing takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of years to get results. Remember, we said earlier, took 10 years before we were sick, and something like 4 collective bargaining elections before we won PEF.
Right.
10 years.
A lot of money. And a lot of time and resources.
A lot of time, yeah. Absolutely.
Right. Do you want to talk about one of the longest committees you've been on? Was Democracy Committee. Now, AFT has always been active with international. As you were saying, you have, you know, resolutions from the 20s, 30s. Selma Borchardt was our international person back then. And now you were leading. And you came in, were you part of the international committee from the beginning? I mean, you started 78?
Yeah, I was on international affairs, I think, right away, and I chaired it very early on.
Okay. It was just right around when, with Poland erupting?
Well, remember, Poland, it was early 80s, and Poland was, martial law was declared, all the unions had to go underground. You had a series of events that took place around the world. That Al Shanker, by the way, who was also the chairman of the AFL-CIO's International Affairs Committee. And Al was intimately involved. He was the motivator. He understood the connection between he understood that in order to further democracy in the world and to strengthen it at home, he understood that you really had to fight for democracy all over the world. And so all of a sudden you had a decade, the 80s, where there were special dramatic events that took place. Poland. And where's the leadership of the fight for democracy in Poland? The unions, trade unions. In Chile, Pinochet, the overthrow of Pinochet, where did it come from? Well, lots of groups, but one of the groups were the teachers, the colegio, the profesores. In South Africa, the apartheid movement, teachers played a tremendous role. And during those years, during apartheid, I mean, David Dorn and I went to South Africa in probably about 1980.
You were in South Africa in 1980?
Yeah. To, as tourists.
Mm-hmm.
We were there to meet with the teachers and other union activists in the black community in Soweto. In we went and developed relationships there. About 3 or 4 years later, one of my proudest moments was when I was refused a visa from the South African government because they knew that we were there and meeting with certain people and all that.
How did you manage to get into the black community in 1980 to meet with them? You had contacts, but the government knew you were there, what you were doing, and you decided...
Well, we were there a couple of times. I was there as part of an AFL-CIO. You will love this. As part of an AFL-CIO study group made up of 3 white trade unionists and 3 black trade unionists. This was during the apartheid regime. And the apartheid regime was so weird that they allowed, remember now, the apartheid regime wanted international recognition. And so they allowed groups in at certain times. The blacks in our group, of course, we would not go unless we could eat together, sleep in the same hotels together, so on and so forth. And we were able to, because the government said the blacks will be honorary whites. And they were whites. And they were allowed to do, I remember reading the papers then, and there were lists in the papers each day. The following people who were colored are now considered black. The following people who were white now considered colored, or back the other way, the following people who were Indian. You could go and petition to change your, it was a fairyland. It was absolutely insane. But we went there as a study group. We met with people in the, we went to Durban and met with the leaders of the hemp makers who make the bottoms of rugs, and met with the workers there. And we were allowed to do all that, by the way. I'll never forget it, going there, and the workers were saying to us, talk about a global view of the world. The workers, when we met with them, said, we understand that the building of new homes is slowing down. Is that true? Why were they interested in that? Because these guys make the wall-to-wall carpets.
Yeah.
And if that's slowing down, they've got a problem. This was back in the 80s. I mean, it's just fascinating stuff. But at any rate, what was very interesting was that in our dealings with the teachers and other union fledgling groups in South Africa, in Chile, in Poland, and these were places that had caught the attention of the world, we were involved because we had these relationships and because they were involved. No surprise. I mean, unions know they cannot function in a dictatorship. Educators know they cannot function as educators in a dictatorship. So what's the big surprise that these people are part of the, you know, of the movement? But have you seen the 1990 AFT convention video, international affairs video? Well, that showed all of that. And I was asked a couple of years back, 5 years or so, to put together a seminar workshop for our newer leaders to kind of make them aware of the history of AFT's international work. So I had time on my hands, and I said, you know, I wonder if AFT's international preoccupation and emphasis on international affairs is because in the 80s, we've had these dramatic moments. Or is it something else? So I went back and I started reading resolutions, going back to, you know, we started in 1916. Holy mackerel. So here you have whereas in the war-devastated regions of Austria and Hungary, the state-paid teachers in common with other public employees are paid in a depreciated currency and receive salaries too small to support life. We support, you know, so on and so forth. 1920. In 1920, it probably took 6 weeks to write a letter to find out about it.
Yeah.
And 6 weeks more. This is, by the way, 1920 is when the union's treasury was something like $122. And they're writing resolutions about the teachers in Austria-Hungary. I'm on a kick, forgive me.
Go right ahead.
Wait a minute. Yeah, I got some other stuff. 1936. This is a discussion on the floor of the convention. I wish to make a statement right here, whether you agree with me or not. If I were in Spain now, I would put a musket over my shoulder and fight on the popular front. Applause. If anybody wants to take up a collection, I will contribute out of my small means. Nevertheless, the problem is here. Are we going as a convention to try to save Spain and interfere in the Spanish War? I mean, you got stuff here. There's a resolution in here. I don't have it right in front of me. Mm-hmm. From 1924 or 25. A resolution that said we should create an international affairs committee. And then parentheses, non-paid. End parentheses.
You show that to David Dorn?
1939. Resolved that the AFT and Conventional Assembled hereby places itself on record as favoring a consumer's boycott of all goods and materials produced in Germany, Italy, and Japan. Why? Because they have abolished democratic forms of government, destroyed trade unions, persecuted racial, political, and religious minorities, and violated the national independence of other countries. It goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
It's the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. So what you have here is creation of a union by a series of people who, even back then, when you didn't hear what the hell was going on for 3 months across the Atlantic, were vitally interested on the basis that they understood that without a support for democracy, all the things that they believed in, a public school system where people could really question instead of just sit and listen and write, a trade union movement where people have the right to join together. You know, all those things. That comes from the very beginning of this union. So it's a mistake to think, and I've heard people say now, well, you know, we were so lucky in the 80s. We had drama. We had Chile. We had South Africa. We had Poland. Hey, we had Austro-Hungary that nobody knew about in 1920 that delegates to our conventions. And by the way, those, you know, how many delegates went to these conventions? 72.
Yeah.
So there is an understanding of the importance of freedom and democracy, freedom of association, rule of law, so on and so forth. That's not just something that history teachers want to teach. That's something that's in the gut of AFT's teachers and members. And by the way, this stuff, we're part of Educational International. We're also part of, because the nurses are with us and because the public employees are with us, we're part of the International Trade Secretariat for Public Employees. And the nurses bought right into this. Hmm. And the nurses have been in South Africa on the AIDS matter, AFT nurses, mm-hmm. talking and making presentations at the AFT Executive Council on the need for us to be supportive of the AIDS programs in those countries. When I went to South Africa 4 or 5 years ago, Barbara and I were there to represent AFT at the South African Teachers Convention. Guess who it was who fought with the government. You know, the guy who took Mandela's place,
yeah,
has said AIDS. You
know. Wash your hands or something like that, yeah.
Guess who's fighting them? COSATU and FOSATU, the teachers' unions of South Africa. And we watched a film at the convention of the president of the South African teachers, who is now also the president of EI, drawing blood. Saying it's okay to do this. We have to do this. We have to know if we are infected or not. I mean, it's really dramatic stuff.
That's huge.
So international affairs is not a frill. It's part of the gut of the organization. And I believe always will be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It will never go away, no. It's been established for a long time.
I think it's what motivated me to to want to remain a part of AFT for as long as, you know, as I was there.
The international issues?
I think so.
And convention used to have, still does, but international guests arriving from fledgling democracies. AFT brought in the Chinese who stood up in Tiananmen Square. And most recently, that woman who wrote Reading in Tehran.
Yeah.
Recognizing that there is a spark of democracy within these countries, and AFT brings them out.
And, you know, every year at our human rights luncheon, we give the Bayard Rustin Award, which is an international award, you know, for those who have promoted human rights and democracy in the world, so on and so forth. So it's built in. It's built in.
And it's, what else has the AFT done to bring in teaching? Like, the Eastern Bloc goes down. Democracy is a strange word to a lot of these teachers. It's because they've not been able to teach democracy. Did the AFT set up funds or organizations to help teach democracy?
Yeah. AFT, the Democracy Committee has a budget for just such these things, for things just such as this. And if you look at the minutes of the Democracy Committee meetings, you will see a whole series of recommendations for funds, some as little as $2,000, some as much as $30,000, to go to various teacher groups in Africa, in Asia, you know, in all parts of the world, to help them fund various programs that have to do with human rights, that have to do with democracy building, to have to do with developing teacher curriculums. There are, David Dorn can show you all kinds of lesson plans and curricula and stuff on how does a teacher function in an open society. What's the nature of the difference as to how you teach a class, you know, the Socratic method, so on and so forth.
Right.
So it's all there.
And this is the National Endowment for Democracy?
The National Endowment for Democracy, we've had, Al was on the board, Sandy was on the board, Ed is now on the board. The National Endowment is funded by Congress.
Right.
And it's part of a... but that is a separate entity. That's not part of AFT.
But did AFT develop this idea?
We're supportive of it.
Okay.
We were supportive of the creation of it.
Right. Right.
It's called Gershwin's Group.
Going back to Poland, though.
Yeah.
UFT was the office for Solidarity for a while. I remember Tom telling me the story that Al calls him up and says, "You got room? We need room in NYSED's office. We need room in the UFT office."
Yeah, we had. We were able to. The teacher leaders of Solidarity. The two teachers who were leading the Solidarity teachers wing, who were on the Solidarity Executive Committee, I believe that they were the only two who were not caught during martial law when they had to go underground. That was Victor Kalierski and Andrzej Janowski. And when they came here, and they came to Albany. I remember Barbara said, "They're probably spending all their time in hotels. Let's have them stay at the house." So they stayed at the house with us. And we would talk all night long. And these guys were wide awake. And in the morning, they would go to sleep. And at one point, I mentioned it. "I don't know how you guys can stay up." And they said, "Well, under martial law, the only time we could do anything was at night." So we would sleep all day for a number of years. I mean, they couldn't see their families or anything, but they would be able to get out at night. So when they came here, these guys were night owls. I mean, they were fascinating. But what was interesting was so there was a close relationship, and even in the underground, there were ways that we were able to be helpful. Fascinating when the when Solidarity won and the Soviets were gone and the government was overthrown and there was an election. Well, Viktor Kolesky and Andrei Janovsky became high officials in the Ministry of Education and were smart enough to know that they had to give up their positions in Solidarity, in the teachers' union. They couldn't sit on both sides of the fence. Right. First time I went there was when the Soviets were still in charge. Jaruzelski was still in charge. And I remember going there, and it was like Maxim Gorky's The Lower Depths. Nobody smiled. Everybody walked with their head down. Really. All the soldiers with rifles at the airport, so on and so forth. And a year or two afterwards, I was invited over to meet with Viktor and Andrei at the ministry. And in a matter of 2 years, you drove into Warsaw, and there were young people walking hand in hand. There were sidewalk cafes. Hmm. People were laughing and smiling. It was just incredible. Hmm. It really was.
What a turnaround.
Oh, just unbelievable.
And imagine the same kind of feeling when you went to South Africa.
Yeah.
Complete turnaround.
Yeah. Just unbelievable.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that's, Eddie McElroy said to me once, and I'll never forget it because I believe it also. He said, you know, if I buy the farm today, AFT doesn't owe me a thing. They have done such wonderful, and I feel that way. I mean, it just opened a whole world to me.
Mm-hmm. You know? Oh, absolutely.
Go back to the beginning. I was a kid whose father owned a candy store, parochial, you know. And through the union movement and education and knowing Al Shanker, it's a whole world opened to me.
You said you visited, what, almost 40 countries?
Yeah.
Participated in some of the most, you know, groundbreaking events internationally.
Yeah. So, you know, the AFT don't owe me a thing. I owe the AFT.
Another question about Chile.
Yeah.
And what's his name? Oslavado?
Osvaldo Verdugo.
And he's the one he was at an AFT convention, was he not?
He was at a couple of AFT conventions. Yeah. And he invited us to be international observers. About 20 or 25 of us went and were international observers at the plebiscite.
Okay.
As to whether or not the vote as to whether or not Pinochet would continue as president to have another term of 8 years. And it was vote no. I should take you upstairs before we leave and show you some of the signs and stuff.
Cool.
And we went, and I was assigned with Tony Ramirez. Tony was a wonderful guy who was a reporter for the UFT newspaper. Antonio Ramirez, terrific guy. Tony and I were assigned to a place way out. I don't know, we drove for 2 hours to watch the vote. The most important thing about that for me was to see how even in dictatorships world opinion is very important to them. People who you would think, these guys are dictators, they don't give a damn what anybody else thinks. Oh yes, they do. They care. When people write letters to General Mobutu,
mm-hmm.
about somebody who's languishing in jail, they say, this isn't going to make it real. It does make difference. It makes a difference. I remember when Vladimir Bukovsky, who was a dissident, Soviet dissident, and when Sharansky, who was a Soviet dissident, when they got out, one of the first things they said was, we knew in our jail cells when people were fighting for us, and that's what gave us sustenance and kept us going. It makes a difference. It really does. I got off my point. I was just going to tell you something about...
You're an election observer in Chile. You just sent up to some little... a Tony.
And we were told that we would not stay in the little town because they were afraid that there might be trouble. Mm-hmm. And we were taken to a place way outside of town. And all of a sudden we go into a driveway, and the driveway goes for a mile, and you come up on this magnificent building, hotel, really weird. And we go inside, and there are, I guess they figured it would be safe because these were supporters of Pinochet. They have pictures of Pinochet. And there's a woman, this is 1980s, about 40 years after World War II. And there's a tall, blonde woman with a thick German accent who owns the place. And she welcomes us. And I say to her, it's a wonderful place you have. How long have you been here? She says, we came about 40 years ago. And I felt sweat going down my back.
Yeah.
So I knew what that was. But at any rate, the next day, we went to observe, and people were very solicitous of us, you know, the observers, the international observers have come. And there were long lines, and people stood in lines in the hot weather for hours and hours and hours, and nobody complained because they were given a chance to vote.
Right. There were no trips around, or there were, but they
there
just...
There were some, right, yeah. No, but it was okay.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, gee, how many Americans would stand for 6 hours? You know?
Yeah.
But, of course, Americans, you know, vote every couple of years.
Yeah.
These folks, that was the one, I think that was the one, where Tony Ramirez, who was going to write articles, said to a woman online, how long have you been waiting? And she said, 40 years.
There you go. That's nice. Were you also an election observer in South Africa?
No.
No, you didn't go?
No, I was not. I don't recall.
Yeah.
Why not?
But you've, sticking to the international thing, just shifting a little bit, you also dealt with democracies, already established democracies, and their trade unions, France and Japan. Actually, I want to know more about France. Wasn't there always an issue with the French unions, communist control, the democratic control?
Oh, sure.
What was?
And that remember that goes back to to the end of the of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
You had when the Marshall Plan was put together. The communist unions in France, in Le Havre, the dock workers refused to offload the goods, the Lend-Lease goods coming from the United States because they didn't want the economy to prosper. They wanted chaos so that the communists could take over.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through Irving Brown and others in the AFL that they were able to get the democratic French trade unions to literally battle in the streets with these guys so that they could offload. And I tell you that because, and the truth is, they saved Europe.
Right.
So there is that history. And in France in particular, you've got the dichotomy of extremely active, committed communist unions, an extremely active, committed democratic unions. And it goes back,